Hi, this is Kenneth Nguyen. A few years ago, before I launched the Vietnamese podcast, my father and all of his siblings passed away. Their passing marked the loss of their stories and the connection to my grandparents and great-grandparents. This is partly what inspired me to start the work of the podcast. Many of you still have the opportunity to record and preserve the legacies of your own families. I've just begun to sit with a few families now for interview sessions to record the rich histories of their parents and the lives of the generations that preceded them. Don't let your family's stories go untold. Take a moment to reach out to me, and together we will bring out your family's story on a recorded journey. I've included the link in the episode description. Visit VietnamStoryBank.com today for more information.
I'm Hoang Nguyen. I am a leisure scientist working at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, living in Livermore, California.
Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. Not in a million years did I ever think that I would grow up to be a scientist, but let alone a laser scientist. I'm curious, how did you arrive in your life to go, one day this is what I'm going to be doing for the next three, four decades of your life?
Yeah, it's actually an interesting story. I don't know. I, unlike a lot of my friends that kind of dreamt about being scientists or working with lasers ever since they were young, that wasn't my story at all. And I just kind of fell into this occupation. And so, we grew up in a very fairly blue collar community. And it was pretty clear and evident to our family at a very young age that, if we wanted to go college, which was a big deal. And so, as going higher education, going to college is a big thing. But actually paying for it was never discussed. And so, I did fairly well in high school grade wise and was able to lucky enough to get, a scholarship at a local college called Oregon Institute of Technology. And, it was, I think, their presidential scholarship, which gave me tuition, books, supplies, and even room and board. And so it was pretty clear that I was going to go to Oregon Tech. And I really didn't know what I wanted to do. And Oregon Tech is, one of the central schools, in the Oregon educational system that focused on, engineering technology, and those sort of, majors. And so when I met with the counselor and person goes, what are you interested in? I said, I don't really know. I really like business. I really like chemistry. And they go, we don't have either one of those subjects here. Just looking at, your math grades and things. And I think they probably also thinking you're Asian, right? You're pretty good at math. We have this new curriculum that is, up and coming. It's super difficult, but, I think it's right up your alley and it's lasers up. And the professor came from a very prestigious university to start this program from the Optical Science Center in Arizona to start this program here in Oregon, at Oregon Tech. And so that's how I fell into that. And it wasn't until, I guess it was my junior year, I just kind of flailed around, took the classes. It was actually a really hard major, really, really tough. I think we started with, couple of hundred students my freshman year. I mean, it was an auditorium and we graduated seven in my class.
Wow.
And of the seven, I think there's only five of us from the original group. And the other two were from a prior class. So it was pretty demanding. But I just was never really into this subject until my summer, my junior year, I applied for an internship at Lawrence Livermore where I'm working now. And this physicist offered me a job to come and work for him in the summer to build lasers from materials that he actually developed, him and his group developed here. And so I came down here and worked for, as an internship, and really, started to see, some of the amazing and fun, exciting work that was being done in this field. And opened my eyes to this whole new world. And the work that I did with this physicist turned out to be, pretty phenomenal. And so he wanted me to stay, and I at the time needed a senior thesis as well. And so I asked him, I said, can I just do this work for my senior thesis? And he says, yeah, absolutely. So I ended up staying and working, for the next year off and on weekends through holidays and stuff, coming down here between school and, doing this laser building up kind of a new laser material in a laser system as my thesis. And then from there, he linked me up with another physicist that was starting a new technology here at Lawrence Livermore, and I hired on with him after I graduated. So,
And
yeah.
that was the late 80s.
This was early 90s, so it was 92.
92.
Yeah.
Because I just imagine the landscape of war and technology in the early 90s, late 80s. I'm not thinking of a whole lot of missile systems or anything guided by lasers yet, is it?
Back then, probably not. I think lasers and optics are kind of synonymous with each other from a technology. And so, lasers have been around for, quite a few decades, but actually, using lasers has been more kind of like commercial, industrial type of applications, right? We've been using lasers like to read CD players, for instance, for a very, very long time. Lasers for, measurements for construction and roads for surveying has been around for a long time. We know laser pointers have been for a long time. So these are, lower power kind of devices and systems. But now, you're seeing lasers more ubiquitous in sort of high powered applications like machining, like cutting up steel, in automotive industry, in the manufacturing industry. So you're starting to see kind of lasers everywhere. Sorry about that.
Now, when I think about these different institutions in America, all over the country, and even all over the world, you could say there's things that we don't know about. Livermore Labs is a thing that very few of us know about. And I know of, quote unquote, the lab from you, but I looked into the Livermore Labs and I didn't realize like it's an actual real, I mean, I use the word institution with a capital I.
Yeah.
It's a real prestigious place, and I'm learning that as I've researched about where you work. Can you tell me a little bit about the history of that lab?
Yeah, I feel extremely fortunate to be working here. And this is actually my second stint at the lab. And so I started, as I mentioned, right out of college. And I actually left for a number of years and went down and worked, in the industry, private industry, in Silicon Valley. And then came back to the lab. But the lab's been around, since, the times of World War II. And you've seen some of this, a little bit of, discussions about the lab, in the Oppenheimer. And so some of that work, with the atomic bomb was done here at the lab. So the lab has a history and, with involvement, and still is heavily involved with the country's nuclear arsenal. And so a good portion of the lab still works in that area where, one of the major missions of the lab is to maintain and verify and help make sure that the current arsenal of nuclear weapons is going to function properly. But on top of that, the lab's also researching and developing potential, new designs and of nuclear weapons here. So that's ongoing. But also the lab now has proliferated into almost every other area of science. From supercomputing here at the lab, biology to material science, to lasers and optics, to the environment. And so we dabble, in almost every area. And I'm a little bit, I guess embarrassed to say that I actually know, a very small portion of what the lab does. It's amazing to me as I wander around and go to different meetings and, and visit different groups, all the things that, that the lab actually has its fingers on. It's super impressive. And it's a really unique place. One of the things I learned, when I went to private industry is, what we do at the lab is very different than what's done in private industry. You actually need a place like a national lab where you're not, where your objective is not to make, a widget or make hardware to make money, right? When you're driven by a business objective, it's different than advancing and developing technologies. One of the big things that national labs do is they work on technologies that private industry can't afford to, or doesn't make good business sense, right? And then what we do is we turn around and give that back to industry. So most of the technologies that I work on is readily available to U.S. industry. And, our group and my program and all of the lab has a very rich history of transferring technology out to industry. It's one of, it's one of the things that we do focus on and pride ourselves on is doing that.
And when it goes from your lab to private industry, does private industry have to pay for the rights to use the technology, or is it given as an incentive to kind of grow the economy here in America?
Yeah, there's different avenues for that approach to that. You as a private industry can come to the lab and actually hire a team here at the lab to develop a technology for you. And those are called cooperative research agreements, CRADAs. Or you can take something that's already been developed that has been publicly released and available and license that. And so there are licenses and royalties that the lab, sets for these technologies, but they're very minimal. They're not, it's very inexpensive to license technology from lab. And very easy to license technology from the lab.
Now, does that mean that other countries can go in and just purchase that technology as well, or is it kind of only limited to American business?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not very familiar with that side. I have not seen at least the work that we've done and have made available to the public for licensing, being licensed outside of the U.S. I'm sure that if you are, an ally of the U.S., then that technology could be made available. Some of it is what they're considered as export controlled, and that sort of technology would not be available.
Yeah,
and it's sort of on a specific technology basis.
I love that. It's like export control. What a wonderful way to put it.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. Yeah.
So I this podcast, I mean, you've known me for a long time now, and this podcast is not meant to like go into any weird attack mode, but I do have a question about the ethics of a scientist like yourself when you are developing these systems that is capable of taking out life. Do you ever have to contemplate those sort of questions?
No, absolutely. I think if you're at all a good person, you have to think about these things, right? You have to, or I don't know if you have to, but you should think about these things, right? So for me, I am a strong believer in deterrent. Yeah, I'm big, big, strong believer in deterrent. And it's unfortunate that, that nuclear weapons exist. But they do. And I'm glad that we have them and control them. But it's one of those Pandora's box. I know it's a cliche, but it really is. And, and, if you watched any of, and seen any of the discussions on a potential nuclear war, there's no winners, right? I mean, everybody's a loser. But there, we live in a world and have lived in a world where ideology is, very dominant. And present. And there are lots of people in this world, even though they're a super small percentage, right, that can wreak, amazing amount of havoc on the rest of us, with just a simple decision. And, I'm a big believer that us having nuclear weapons, provides us with the safety, this deterrent from others attacking. I always talk and think about, if Ukraine, right? Ukraine, when they became their own country, had to give up their nuclear weapons, right? And we're seeing kind of the hardships and what's going on between with the Ukraine war and what Russia is doing, to Ukrainian people, because of, this ideology. And would Russia have to attack Ukraine if they had nuclear weapons? I don't think they would have. So my belief is that it probably wouldn't have happened, and potentially Ukraine and its people would not be in the position that they are now. And really not just Ukraine, but really, all of Western society, all of Europe, right? Everybody that borders Russia, all the countries that border Russia are extremely fearful. Right? And so for those countries that don't have nuclear weapons, thank goodness there's NATO, and that they're, they can band together, the allies, the European, Western countries can band together, to put up, this, the stiff front, towards Russia. But, and I think lasers in used as, a war type of device or systems. Yeah, you're going to see it, unfortunately. So the laser weapon systems that, we've been, helping develop in that you're starting to hear a lot about in the public domain, is meant to be a defensive system. But, just like with, anything that's defensive, it can always have, an offensive use too, as well, right? So yeah, no doubt that you'll see that. So it's hard to think about that. But the other thing that gives me kind of like solace is that, I'm also a big believer in giving our war fighters the best technology that we possibly can to help ensure that they get home to their families. That these, young women and men, older women and men, have a huge sacrifice, right? I mean, to, stand on the wall, as you'd say, sit on the wall and provide this protection for us. And whatever I can do or help with, to bring them home to their families is a big deal. And so, if I hope I am contributing in that way, and that is something that gives me, comfort.
Before we get into the meat and potatoes of the mechanical side of lasers and the industry of lasers and your awards and all the good stuff, I want to ask a wacky question. The wacky question is, when you've traveled, because I know you've traveled quite a bit around the world, and you see certain sort of cuts in stones or you see certain things, do you ever go like, was there a civilization here before that had lasers? You ever think about that?
Not lasers so much, but I think I do wonder, you know, you see, you know, you hear, you know, there's these documentaries and shows that talk about, you know, ancient civilization here before us, right? And yeah, you know, some of the stuff that's done is just absolutely amazing. And you think about, you know, all the tools that, you know, that we utilize, you know, to craft something, to move something, right? To make something. And how was this done so primitively back, you know, you know, hundreds of years ago? Yeah, it's, I, you know, I don't discount that there could have been, you know, when you look up in the sky, you know, it's a big, you know, big unknown, right? And how can we be potentially the only, you know, living beings or human beings, you know, in this universe? It's, you know, we just look up there and it's full of stars, you know, which means it's full of planets and galaxies. And yeah, it's just hard to fathom that.
Yeah, there's some.
We're the only ones.
Yeah, there's some temples in Angkor Wat or all around the world where there's like cuts where you're just like, this is impossible for even like modern day. Like there's cuts behind crevices where you can't see, or but you could feel your way. You could put your hand in it and it's smooth and it's cut. But you're like, how did they do that when it's just one piece of rock?
It's perfectly cut.
Perfectly cut.
Yeah. And yeah. Yeah, I agree. It's I don't know. I don't know the answers to that, but it is an interesting question. Huh? It's fun to think about.
Yeah. And I you know, because you've been around and was wondering if that you ever come across stuff that that you're like, wait, this is the technology that we have, but how did they do this in the ancient times? You know, and that always interesting.
Yeah, I'm kind of the other way around. You know, when I go to places and look at things that are being manufactured or made and they're not using a laser, I'm always thinking, why aren't you using a laser? And so I think, you know, everything can be done with a laser, or, you know, so I'm kind of the opposite, I guess, in that sense. Yeah.
You've explained lasers to me one time at a dinner, and I wanted to, you know, get it on the record and share with our audience. How do lasers work, and why are some lasers able to cut through surfaces?
Yeah. So lasers, right? So lasers is actually an acronym, right? So LASER. So it stands for light amplified stimulated emission radiation. Okay. So that kind of explains what happens or what a laser is. So laser basically is made up of light, right? So light from our screen, light from the bulbs above us, light from the sun, right? The difference is those light, that type of light, is what's known as incoherent light. And incoherent means that each individual light beam, you can think of it as a light beam or a photon, is not traveling in sync with each other, okay? And so each one has its own direction, its own angles. And so it, you know, that's why you kind of see this more fluorescence, this flood of light. A laser beam, you know, as most people see it, like your laser pointer, actually is very directional, right? It's just, it starts out very small and it can grow big, but it can also be small and stay small, but it's very directional. What happens, the difference is these, you know, beams of light or photons of light are actually what's known as coherent, or they're in phase with each other. So they're traveling in the same direction, and they can add together to make, you know, a stronger output of light, okay? And so the way that happens, the way that lasers in the simplest form is made, is you have some material that you can excite and generate photons, of light. So little photons of light. And so light, the photons of light you're seeing illuminate my skull. What you want to do is now put those into what they call a resonator or a cavity where you can get them to travel together. And so the simplest of laser is basically a laser ganglion that you can excite to generate your emission of light. And then you trap them between two mirror so that they bounce back and forth and start to sync up with each other or start to, you know, be coherent. And then you let a little bit of that leakage out of this trapped, you know, area. So think of it as like a tube with two mirrors. And so light just kind of rattles back and forth there. And then the tube has a little hole in it, or partially, you know, a film that allows a partial reflection out of that. And that's how a laser is actually produced. So that it's this amplified, you know, emission that occurs. So every time the light passes through this game medium, it gets a little bit stronger and builds up. And the more times it passes through that, the higher the output powers could be. And then, like I mentioned, every pass a little bit leaks out of this, you know, this entrapped area.
How was this figured out?
You know, it's funny because, you know, as I've gotten older, one of the things that is the most important to me in when it comes to work is finding is really not what I do, but who I work for, right? And so I see myself as a person that is very effective at executing a plan. You know, from A to B, I see A to B, you know, really, really well, and I can get to E to B fast and efficient, but I've never been a visionary, you know. And so I always look for the visionary folks to go work for. And it's because these are the people that figure these crazy things out, right? If you look at, you know, I mean, you know, from Galileo, you know, to Einstein, you know, to, you know, I mean, these remarkable individuals that I think it's hard for us to comprehend what these, you know, to be on the same sort of plane as these folks, right? Like, I mean, look at Elon Musk, right? A person that can go from PayPal to building, you know, electric cars, really making, you know, bringing electric cars to the forefront, to building spaceships, right? Reusable rockets that can land itself, right? Booster rockets that will land itself, where NASA spent, you know, decades and, you know, never got the reusable rockets, right? These individuals, I think, are absolutely just incredible. And these are the folks that think about and come up with these things that you know, we don't, you know, that we just can't, you know, imagine. And so, for me, it's, you know, I'm not one of those people. I'm more of, you know, a practical, applied person. And like I said, I'm great at executing, making things work.
This episode is brought to you by Red Boat Fish Sauce. I love cooking with Red Boat because it's made with only two ingredients, wild-caught anchovies and sea salt. This premium fish sauce is made in Phu Quoc, Vietnam, and bottled right here in California. You can find Red Boat at select Asian supermarkets like 99 Ranch, H Mart, and Tung Fak. Yeah, I the more you explain it, the more lost I find myself getting. you know, because how do you go from like things that are escaping, light particles or whatever that are escaping a tube, and what makes it regroup to come out so sharp and powerful, right? And it's just,
yeah,
sounds like a random escape, but how are these random escapees like getting together and coming out so?
Yeah, so good way to think about it. A good way to think about it is, you know, I think we're all familiar with the of using a magnifying glass to burn wood or paper or something, right? So here you're taking a magnifying glass, which is, an optic that focuses light, right? And you're collecting light from the sun, which is incoherent, right? So the sunlight, when I talk about incoherent, that means that, right, that it gives you kind of this broad area. And what you're doing is you're taking a magnifying glass and focusing it to a really tight spot, right? So tight that you can burn wood or paper with it. And the bigger, if you watch some of these YouTubes, some of these folks like use these gigantic lenses. Instead of using a little, a couple inch magnifying glasses, they use gigantic lenses that are several feet in diameter. And there you're collecting, more light, proportionally to that size of the optic. And you can boil water, you can melt steel with this, right? So laser is just really an extension of that, essentially. But the difference is instead of using light that can't, that is, that's incoherent or not in phase with each other, you're using, laser uses light that is coherent and in phase. And so there's a terminology called superposition. And so if you take like a sine wave, right? Or a sine wave. And if the sine waves are off shift where you have a peak and a valley that are directly opposite from each other, they cancel, right? Does that make sense?
Yep.
And then if they're right on top of each other, they actually add, right? And so laser is like that too. So when I talk about coherent light, it's light that, think about it in a sine wave where those peaks and valleys are perfectly lined up with each other. So they add together, where incoherent light, that sinusoidal pattern of each, of each particle can be all in different places. So that's what keeps them from, really being additively or growing in power is because there's no, because they're not locked to each other.
And does
Yeah.
the same
So,
mechanics apply when you crank up the laser for more strength?
yeah. So building lasers for higher power is, is really adding in more either. What you have to use basically produce more gain. Oh, it's a good analogy is like using a car stereo, right? So car stereo, you start with some really small signal that you generate from either in the old days from a CD, or it's probably easier to talk about a CD or a signal that you pull out of the ear from radio, right? And so that's actually a really small, tiny signal. And what you have to now do is then amplify that signal so that you can actually move woofers. Speakers are really moving air, right? Woofers and tweeters, is really moving air. And so you take a little signal and you slowly process it and then you amplify it. Then you send it to additional amplifiers and, to increase that signal strength. And then if you want something really loud, if you look at, in some of these cars and some of these audio, follower folks that are really into, music systems, they have a car full of amplifiers. You open up and, there's like, many stages of amplifiers. Building a laser or increasing a laser power is exactly the same thing. You start with a very small signal and then you have amplifier stages to increase to increase the output, the final output. The difference is the amplifier stages are these other laser medium that you can, electrically pump, optically pump to produce the gain that you need. So in car stereo, your amplifiers are driven by, electricity, right? And so, in laser systems, they can be driven electrically, but they can also be driven optically as well. So they can be pumped by other lasers, or they can be pumped with flash lamps, or they can be pumped with laser diodes or other forms of light. And then it can also be electrically pumped as well. Yeah.
Are there things that you see in the future that you're like, we can't figure out how to get there right now, but there is a possibility of doing that? Is there technology that you are looking at every day or have been contemplating for the last 3 decades and saying it could do something like that if we could just figure out how to do it, but that potential is there? Do you have anything like that?
In lasers? I don't know about in lasers. I guess part of it's because it's amazing to me to see, where lasers have gone and have come from and where it's at now. And I think the potential is for improved laser systems is pretty readily attainable. Like one of the big things in the laser industry right now is laser fusion power plant, right? So the lab recently demonstrated laser fusion for first time ever, by a huge deal within the scientific community. So this is like Nobel Prize winning type of achievement, and it's taken the lab many decades. Just the enormous amount of just incredible minds to make this happen. And really one of the next steps in this laser fusion is how do you take what the lab's done and move it towards being able to make a power plant for generating electricities, for everyday households and for individual consumptions. And that laser system is very, very different than the laser system that, the lab used to demonstrate this fusion. The laser the lab used to demonstrate fusion, is a research tool that fires, once every day or once, several hours, where a laser for a power plant, a fusion for power plant generation, needs to fire like 10 times a second, right? And so, but even thinking about the difference in those two systems, I easily see the technology, the laser technology that gets us to there. The thing that is not laser that I always that I always kind of think about is really space travel. Space travel is a fun, technology to kind of think about. Elon Musk and NASA's, talking about going to Mars, right? But, when we talk about other potential planets like Earth, they're light years away, right? And then growing up watching Star Trek, and the shows of nowadays, there's these warp drives or wormholes, right? That is a gateway between, a shortcut between, galaxies. And I think that's the stuff I think is really cool.
Fascinating.
Because, nothing that we make, approaches anything near the speed of light, right? And so if we're talking about we're talking about, planets being hundreds of light years away, how are we going to get there? And if you think about, getting back to, kind of like, alien life, right? I mean, if there was alien life that came to Earth, that means somehow they have harnessed this knowledge of traveling what we deem as light years, right? And so those, I think that sort of area is more perplexing and to me than I think what's possible with lasers. I think every day we find new applications and new places to use lasers, and then we morph our lasers for that. But I don't think we're kind of done with areas where lasers can be used yet. I don't even think we're close.
Now, talk about the use of a laser. When we talk about laser guided, I can't wrap my mind around what that means. It's like, is the laser shooting out? Because it's only like a straight line, right? And
Yeah, for the most part, straight line, yes. Line of sight.
Is it actually guiding a missile to go somewhere, or does it put a point down and the missile finds that point because the laser is just pointing at the point?
Yeah, it's more like that. So guided missiles are basically, you have to have some sort, the laser's used as more of a beacon, is the way to think about it. So it's illumination that generates a signal that then the missile's looking for. Yeah. Does that help?
Yeah, but is it a point on the ground? Or
Yes.
is it, so there's a point where it's like, if you're 10,000 feet up, there's a point that's like pointed at that target, and then the
Yeah.
person, the machine, or the missile, it follows it.
Yes. And some of that's actually a point that's generated by, the device itself. And some of it's actually a person on the ground with a laser that's pointing to that place. So there's, yeah, so there's both actually. So a lot of these guided bombs and stuff that you see, used by, or warfighters coming off of jets or bombers or stuff, have the laser guidance on the, on the plane itself. So on that plane somewhere, is a separate laser that, is pointing, it's ranging almost, targeting, where it wants that, bomb dropped. Yeah.
How much further out, I think we talked about it earlier, but how much further out does lasers have to go? I mean, short of like we becoming these sort of like microscopic things that hop on a laser and we travel with the speed of light. I mean, how much further is it in real life application for you? I can imagine you going, okay, there's a target way over there. We're just trying to get it, and we just need to get smaller chips, we have to get better technology. I mean, where is the sort of the goalpost for people like you?
Good question. We so my group here, we don't build a lot of laser systems here. And so we're, the group that I'm working in now kind of work on the components that make lasers. And so I haven't, I guess I shouldn't say that. And so we do more optics for lasers, for laser applications. So for instance, one of the components that we developed that enables a laser technology is this diffractive, a wave dispersive optic. And so, a lot of folks that get laser eye surgery, for instance, right? There's a new class of lasers that do laser eye surgery that is super high precision and produces what the very little collateral damage because it imparts very little amount of heat. So, when you typically see a laser do machining or something, you see sparks flying and stuff. And that's because those type of lasers impart a lot of heat into the workpiece. But there's a class of laser systems that are used for machining, but also for science. That is what they call a cold, cold laser or non-heat generated type of laser systems. And we actually make and fabricate and advance optical components that enables this type of laser. And what this laser is they're good. There are a class of lasers that's called ultra fast lasers. And so it's a laser with very, very short durations. And so you can have a laser that is continuous, kind of like our light is continuous, or you can have lasers with very short bursts of energy. And then that burst can range anywhere from, fractions of a second to to trillionths of a second sort of numbers, super, super short durations. Okay. And so these lasers that have very short, ultra short durations, are a class of lasers that are called ultra fast or chirp pulse amplification lasers. And that requires a very special optical technologies to enable these lasers. And so we make like those optical components. The laser weapon systems that you're starting to see a lot of in the news is made by an optical components that, so there's predominant technology behind these laser weapon systems that you're starting to see out in the news uses a technology that combines a lot of lasers into one beam. And so we found, so scaling lasers, one of your questions, scaling laser output powers. Scaling laser output powers is, and being able to maintain certain optical characteristics like good beam quality. It's like when you take that magnifying glass, right? And you have to get it at the exact right distance so you can get the beam small enough to burn, right? That is a function of what we call beam quality. So to get really good output power and really good beam quality is actually pretty hard to achieve. And building a single laser to do that has been, something that's been very difficult for us to realize. And that's because when you're making something bigger, more powerful, you're requiring more electricity, more, which means more heat. And when you heat something, you actually distort it. And when you distort something, all kinds of bad things happen. You can overheat it and cause damage. You can cause it to degrade, and that nice spot isn't no longer nice and small anymore. So it becomes not very effective. And so, and also bigger systems, that require more pumping and more electricity are not necessarily the most reliable systems because you're overdriving those systems. So what we found is that if you have a bunch of smaller systems that are much more electrically efficient, they're a lot more robust. And so if you can combine a bunch of these together into a single beam, that technology would be easier to realize and more cost effective than trying to build something big. And so the new, so one of the main technologies for these laser weapon systems is a technology called spectral beam combining, where you're taking a lot of these number of little lasers and putting them together to make one big laser. And the main component that allows for that combination to occur.
Okay, I got okay, let me ask the question. So what's your day-to-day look like?
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. I'm super lucky and fortunate the fact that I work in this program called NIF, National Enrichment Facility, that specializes really in laser technology. And I've been afforded kind of the opportunity to have a very small group that specializes in a very specific type of laser technology. And we're really kind of the only group of our kind in the world that does all the different things that we do with lasers. And because of that, we get to kind of pick the things that we want to work on and what we work on around, around this kind of technology area. So our group is mostly actually funded from outside of the lab. And so we are involved in certain lab activities within our program, but very small. Most of our work is actually for university or institutions like the lab, other laboratories here within the United States, and also in Europe. And we do a lot of work for some private industries, defense contractors, and a lot of DOD work, defense related work. And so right now, I think we have something like 14 or 16 projects. So we're only a team of six. So the group that I work in is really, really small. But I think we have something like 14 to 16 projects right now. And some of it is scientific, where we're doing, developing and advancing these fundamental optical technologies, for advancing laser technology as a whole. And then we have projects where we are looking at the next generation concepts of laser configurations for the military. And then we're also providing and developing optical subcomponents for either, the military, DoD, or the scientific community. So my day-to-day is kind of crazy. So it starts, while I'm sleeping, typically. Things pop up in my mind of what needs to be done. But I'm very, very hands-on. I work and live in the lab. So on the other side of this wall that you're looking at, so my office is actually where I also do laser work. And so I call it my little skunk work area, where I, play with laser technologies or think about laser technologies, but that's where my office is too. So my day basically starts with thinking about what the group needs to do that day. When you have, this many projects, there's that many deliverables as well. So one of the things that's unique about our group is that most of the projects that we get funded for, it has twofold. But in the end, what really matters is that our customer is getting some sort of widget. We get seldomly ever funded just for basic science, where we can just kind of do basic science, write papers and publications. Typically, we in the end are delivering some sort of hardware to our sponsors. And so what that means is that in our group, we have to balance. There's a balance between trying to do too much and trying, doing too much, in terms of advancements, too much unknown, right? Because part of our charter here at the lab is to push the forefront of science. Do something that industry isn't doing or someone else isn't doing.
How
Do something different.
do you come up with that? How do you say, okay, we're a team of six and we're gonna come together and do things that are not out there? It's like you're creating something from nothing, but like, where's the directive?
Yeah, it's like I think I mentioned earlier, I'm an extremely practical person, and I'm an executor. What I find is most of the technology, even though we see it or you see it or laser folks see it as novel, it's not necessarily novel. It exists somewhere already, right? And maybe I borrow something from, electronics, or I borrow something from the biology discipline, and I bring it into lasers. So it's not novel in some other field, but it's novel in the laser optics field. Or we take technologies from all these different fields and we merge them, right? And so for me, like I mentioned, I've never been much of a visionary in terms of seeing things intrinsically from scratch, right? I'm very sort of application driven, which I kind of deem as problem solving. So someone comes to me and says, we have this problem. What can we do to fix this problem, or what can we develop to fix this problem? And that's where I'm the best at, and so one of the things, like when I was younger, when I first, and this is, advice from a really amazing mentor of mine, and he says, you want to try to broaden be as broad as you possibly can, technologically. Just don't just focus on lasers and optics. Understand what, state of the art is, for electronics, state of the art is for chemistry, state of the art is for computing, And that, is where it's, where you potentially be, the most helpful and useful. And so I've always been pretty good about dabbling and reading and trying to stay on top of, other disciplines. And that has, I think helped me
Help, yeah.
be able to solve some of these problems and come up with some of these solutions and some of these technologies that, that people are after. But yeah, so I've never been a person where you develop something and then the application comes afterwards, right? Where you do something neat and cool, but there's really not a use for it. And then at some point, some later date, someone says, oh yeah, I can use that to do this. I'm more the other way around where, where there's a bottleneck or, there is some sort of hurdle, technological hurdle that can't be overcome. And that, and I, go in and try to figure out how to, to fix that.
How many laser houses are there in the world, or in the, let's start with the United
Oh.
States. At your level, I'm sure it's probably at the high level because there's only, that kind of money in the government funding this. But, typically we're talking, and my question is going to reflect back to Vietnam, and is that the world of Vietnam ever going to see? Or are they seeing any of this technology that's being developed right now? So,
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
but is there, yeah.
We had this project for Nike many, many years ago. This was probably 2 decades ago. And Nike at the time, and still is, right? The shoe companies are, they have to innovate shoes. They pump out new designs and different soles, different, art and stuff. Like every few months or something crazy like that. But it takes a long time, I guess, to tool up a factory and change the tooling to make a given shoe. And so we had developed this technology for laser machining. This is a couple of decades ago. Nowadays, it's everywhere. But back then, it wasn't everywhere. Nike came to us and wanted to talk about making a laser tool that could basically bridge the gap when they thought of something, they could prototype it and potentially make it be, and then at some point their tools would catch up and, get into high production. But, that was in Vietnam. Those tools were meant, and the production at that time was for
Wow.
teams, at the Nike factory, in Vietnam. I think that's probably in Hanoi, right? Somewhere around Hanoi, I think there's that. But, right now, I think, if you look at proliferation of lasers, it's like proliferations of TVs or computers. It's done over in China. I mean, some of the most powerful manufacturing lasers, machine lasers and systems and the lowest cost systems, highest volumes are made in China. I saw a video on YouTube not too long ago, where a company, a Chinese company, was marketing a new cutting laser, and they're cutting through 8 inches of steel with a laser, 8 inches of steel, and done in basically seconds. I mean, and this is a machine that you can buy, now today. So yeah, it's just yeah. So
Have you?
access to these tools, is readily today.
Yeah. Have you been to Vietnam? I should
No, not
ask.
yet.
And what do you think? What do you think you'll come up? What do you think will come up when you get there?
I don't know. I think you and I talked about this briefly, and I never had a huge desire to go to Vietnam until more recent. I shouldn't say it. As I've gotten older and more mature, it's been something on my mind and on my bucket list. But younger growing up, it wasn't so. And part of it is because my dad was in the military and had very adverse feelings towards the communist government, right? And what happened with the war and what happened, after the war with his family, with his dad being thrown in prison and other folks that, that he was really close to, but, that was, badly treated by the communist, government. And so I've always seen, Vietnam being a communist country growing up as, this, very adversary, entity, and it wasn't. And since we really didn't have family there, I didn't have a connection to Vietnam except for this very negative feeling about the country, right? And it hasn't until I've gotten older and more mature, and realized that that we things have changed a lot, and what the government is not what the people necessarily are, right? And this, and mainly, people that are in southern Vietnam are still the same southern, Vietnamese that, my dad were, right? That, where he grew up and where we were, and that folks from, the communist north are not necessarily, the government folks or individuals like us. And as we travel more, I think, it's hard not to realize that, everybody's pretty much the same.
Yeah, and I want to go back to that word, that thing you were just talking about. The government is not the same as the people, and the people are not the government. And but I'll break it down even one more level too. Is the government is not even the government of the people in government, which means that there are a lot of dissenting voices within the government. There's a lot of forces that want to progress the will of the modern world that is happening in the government. And it's like, it's not a clean model
no.
in the world. And, and especially in Vietnam, it's not, it's not one party, what we think, oh, they're trying to do it this. It's
right.
A lot of moving parts.
Yeah. So I think, so we grew up, with from my dad's friends and him, talking war talks and things, one of the things, my dad got together with his friends quite a lot, and we were expected basically to kind of sit there while he hung out with his friend, and so, but that gave us the opportunity to listen, right?
Yeah.
And but it also made us very jaded, right? Because they had a lot of anger, and towards a communist government, right? But as I've gotten older, and traveled, as I mentioned, my belief is that 99.9% of the folks in this world are good people. Very, very good people. And it's the small fraction, extremely small fraction of folks that, that can have tremendous negative effects on the rest of us, unfortunately. And it's a small fraction that unfortunately is very impactful, right? Even though it's a small number, their decisions, can be extremely impactful, and sometimes, way overwhelms the 99.9% of the good that, that's around. And so I think I try to keep that in perspective. And, having, kind of this new, more progressive thinking, it, has made me want to better, kind of connect to, to Vietnam, and it's kind of different for me too. I think, I've talked about this, we grew up in the southern central Oregon town where we're, I think at first the only Vietnamese family there, right? And so I have always kind of seen myself, ethnically, as Vietnamese, but culturally, I'm as American as they come, I don't know if that makes sense or not. And so I grew up around a lot of other Vietnamese families or
yeah, that makes
culture,
sense.
And so I grew up around, a blue collar, Southern Central Oregon, area, and that's, that's where, that's what I resonate with, and that's, that's the foundation of who I am, is this, this upbringing in this town, and it's not, this Vietnamese culture,
But
right?
did you ever have sort of identity crisis issues growing up, or even now, like
What do you mean by that? I guess, what do you mean by identity crisis?
like you never look in the mirror and go, well, because I have this, and I'm only speaking from experience. It's only related because of my mind, when I have this issue of like 1 foot in, 1 foot out. I don't know sometimes why, as I'm doing this journey, I'm learning more, but I didn't know, like those years I was in the Marine Corps, that I was Vietnamese. Obviously, I knew ethnically I came from of the Vietnamese people, but I really could not figure out in my early years who I wanted to be. And I guess that's the question. Like, but you're fully formed
Interesting.
now, you're
Yeah, I guess I don't worry about who I'm going to be more than I think when I think about when you mentioned identity crisis, when I was asking about, about you kind of elaborating at, is that is I guess I've always had a feeling of whether I was in the right place, not knowing where I'm supposed to be. I know who I am, but I never felt like, like when my parents used to travel down to San Jose to visit their friends, and we would go like to the Lion Plaza or somewhere, right? Or to out to a restaurant, which we never did very often, but somewhere where it's all Vietnamese folks. I felt like everybody was staring at me, right? And like I was the odd man out. But at the same time, it happens to me when I am in Klamath Falls. Like I was just back in Klamath Falls this last weekend. My wife's family is still all there, and we go back there and visit. And when I go into restaurants there, and it's predominantly white, I feel like they're all staring at me there too, or we go into the store, and so I'm, so, and I think that's one of the reasons why I love being in California. I love being in the Bay Area. Like when I was working down in Silicon Valley, one of the best things was going in into the cafeteria during lunchtime. You smelled all kinds of different ethnic food. There wasn't, a predominant smell, and there wasn't a predominant, ethnic group, right? I mean, you had Asian, you had Southern Pacific Asians, you had Southern Eastern Asians, you have, Americans, and you have Europeans, you had Hispanic, Southern South. It is awesome. And I think that's one of the awesome things about being in California and being in this area, is I actually don't have, I don't think about not belonging.
Yeah.
And, it's been awesome to raise my kids here because I think, for them, everything is shades of brown, right? There is no person that's white or a person that is black or a person that is brown. To them, it's I don't even think it's something they think about,
No.
and I think that's amazing.
Yeah.
So yeah, so I think, yeah, it's just, I think I'll always have this, this issue of whether or not I fit in, right?
Yeah.
Just because that's how I grew up. I think not being in a Vietnamese community and being Vietnamese, and not and being in a white community but not being white, right? So yeah.
I wonder, like 100 years from now, our descendants are listening to this and they're just like, God, that's trippy. They actually thought that they were
Right.
a part of a cultural group of people. They had their weird tribes and they
Right.
division of tribes and then go to war with each other. And then it's like, maybe 100, 200 years from now, everybody is sort of like the same because of how much mixing is going on. And
Yeah.
we're going to be like these like Navajo tribes, or when they look back at
Yeah.
Comanches, and these are tribes that existed hundreds of years ago in America, but now it's like everybody in America is one ethnic group.
Yeah. But I do hope that, even though, we start to blend in that way, we still are able to preserve our individual cultures, because I think that's important too. You know, because I think we can learn from different, you know, and from different cultures and different traditions. And so I hope there is this blending in a sense, but yet, you know, being able to still preserve, you know, some of our cultural identities.
And
so that that'll be interesting.
Yeah, thank you so much for today. It you know, we talked about the science of this all, and we got into this, you know, the end of our conversation, the cultural side of things. And I look forward to seeing you this weekend and hanging out with you and talking and picking up more of the conversation.
I do too. I appreciate the conversation, Ken. It always helps me to kind of reflect and think about these things and think about how fortunate we are.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to seeing you guys here tomorrow. Yeah.
Yep.
And hanging out and getting some good grub.
All right. Thank you, Anhuang.
All right. Take care, Ken.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Crystal Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.